Welcome back to another episode of Occupy Interview Radio. Today's episode is going to be on prisons and political prisoners. Our guest is going to be David Somerville. He's a retired Army Special Forces veteran, and he's had some interesting experiences with the prisons and the prison industrial complex. Dave, why don't you say hello to us?
Hello. Hello to us.
All right, he's still with us. Anybody want to start off with some questions? Or, you know, David, actually, why don't you start off and tell us a little about yourself? You know what my question was, first question is, what woke you up? What woke you up that, you know, your government is lying to you?
Oh, well, that was my military service back in 78, 79, 80, 81. And that's what really woke me up. I, you know, was raised in Michigan, just believed that the government was all good, but got into military and found out the government's not all good. The government's pretty much corrupt. And, yeah, that just had a devastating impact on me from then on here in life. So I am suspicious.
Can I get a little more, David, can I get a little more specific with you? Because I recall from our conversation yesterday that you said that there was a lot of guys from coming home from Vietnam when you got into the service, that you was the guys that made it through Nam were the guys that were training you. But yep. I guess my question is, did they volunteer to you how things were so screwed up, or was it just so apparent everywhere around you?
Oh, sure, they did. Sure. I mean, this was around the time when they were running the drugs into Mena, Arkansas, and they would tell me, you know, they're the ones, you know, who fly the C-130s or 140s or 141s that they were flying at the time. You know, that they were the ones, you know, I mean, it was the government, it was the CIA that was running those drugs into Arkansas. And they laughed, and they thought it was funny because, you know, the media at the time, I guess, was talking up, you know, trash about all, you know, all the, how the drugs are all coming into Miami and Florida. And they said, you know, this is the big lie that's being put out there. You know, we are really running the drugs into, you know, Arkansas. And so that was, you know, when I just realized that, geez, you know, this is what you guys do, and this is what's been going on. And seeing how they conduct themselves out in, you know, on training exercises, they make, you know, that they make useful idiots out of Americans. So we go on, you know, field exercises and go into areas because we were in the intelligence part of the activities, and so they would you know, go into bars and stuff, and you know, and start screwing with people and just messing with them, and you know, try to get them to do stuff like, we'll try to get the, you know, it was like a game, you know, it's just kind of like a mission to try to get somebody, an unknowing stooge, to take something from here to there and deliver it to some other person they don't know, you know, to just do unwitting stupid things, and you know, to try to, you know, corrupt, you know, women, you know, co-opt them, you know, boyfriend, girlfriend type of things, whatever. I mean, schmooze them, you know, anybody, get any stooge to do something. You know, this was just part of what was going on, is how to make useful idiots out of people who wouldn't know any better. And
David,
yeah.
Did you ever see any drugs?
No, I you know, totally stayed away from any of that. And as far as you know, I would say I would have to take their word for it, you know, that that's what they were doing for some time, but I have no reason to doubt it. You know,
at the level. I can tell you that, you know, back during the first Iraq Gulf War, that my college roommate was getting hash straight from Afghanistan right into an Air Force base in Dayton, Ohio. And I saw it come right off the plane, you know, the guy coming out of the airport, and it even had a Delta logo on the package. What do you think about that? And that's what I was curious, if you ever just kind of, you know, came across it, not like, you know, you were part of it or anything, but, you know, just happened to oversee something getting shipped or whatever.
Nope. No, I tried to avoid all that. I was really a really clean cut, and I was really just, you know, a true believer in, you know, law and order and all that stuff, and, you know, you just, you know, would never have anything to do with stuff like that.
Why did you join the service in the first place? I mean, was it like economics, or was there some sort of patriotic feeling you had?
There was a little patriotic feeling, a little bit of that, you know. I think I was a useful idiot, but at the same time, you know, there was some economics involved. You know, they were advertising at that time, you know, that you could earn like $8,000 for college, and I forget what they called that program now. But basically, you know, I contribute like, you know, whatever, half of that money from my paychecks.
Oh, right, the college fund, the GI fund, right?
I'm sorry?
The GI fund, is that what you're talking about?
Yes. It was something like that. It was
part of the GI Bill, I believe, isn't it?
Or GI Bill, yeah.
Yeah.
It was a real early on precursor to some of that stuff. One of the first programs they offered like that, and I forget what they called it now. But yeah, that was it. And of course, $8,000 for college then. I mean, you know, I contributed, you know, like say half of that, and they matched it. And so, you know, that was a lot of money for college then. Now that's not even a drop of foot. Yeah.
But okay, Terry, did you have a question? Do you want for our guest, or did you want me to keep going here for a little bit?
I was just going to say it's not just what he was hearing. There seems to be quite a bit of documentation that came out during the Iran-Contra hearings, later the series that came out by the journalist who supposedly, after his career was wrecked, was supposed to have committed suicide by regrettably shooting himself in the head twice, according to what the coroner signed off on. Anyway, there seems to be quite a bit of documentation that what he was hearing was what was actually going on. Curious, after you got back out, and I know you were a part of our Occupy America site, and how did you become part of the Occupy movement, Occupy supporter?
Well, I'm pretty sympathetic to the 99% of us who are being abused by the gangster bankers. So, you know, I'm pretty much into any popular movement that's going to hold the criminals in government accountable. And really, you know, when they went to New York, you know, basically to the, you know, to the Wall Street type of a protest, you know, that's where the real criminals are. I mean, those are the folks who are really buying off the rest of government, the ones who really own government. We're looking at, you know, the J.P. Morgans and the Rockefellers, and these folks are the ones who are really, you know, running everything, pulling the strings behind the scenes. I mean, I know there's a whole bunch more of them than just those, but, you know, when they went there to really go after that, I was really pleased with that, to see somebody finally going after the real enemy and not playing this left, right, liberal, conservative, ping pong ball kind of goofball charade. You know, finally somebody's going after the real enemy. So I like that. That's what drew me in.
Hey guys, let me jump in here for a second. Do you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. Bradley, can you check our stream, please? One of our listeners tonight said that we're not getting a stream. So we'll work on that, guys. Hey, Parklar, did you want to jump in there?
Well, no, I didn't really have anything at the moment. I would say, though, that, you know, certainly the drug running does tie into the whole Occupy thing, since they've had so much of exposure on what the banks have been doing with laundering drug money and, you know, to the tune of tens of billions every year. And, you know, it's a real shame that this, you know, this stuff is never prosecuted, because it encourages them to keep doing it. When you fine them, you know, say $10 or $15 million for, you know, and say shame, shame, give them a little slap on the wrist for, you know, laundering all this drug money. Well, you know, businesses have what they call risk management. Risk management is essentially where they take a look at what risk do they take on in breaking the law. And when they see that the risk of laundering tens of billions and making hundreds of millions of dollars off of it, and weigh that versus, a few million in fines, then the answer is, get the Mexican cartels on the phone. Let's do some business, you know?
I'd like to elaborate on that just a tiny bit. If anybody ever gets a chance, you can look up the Opium Wars. This is something that's been going on for the Opium Wars would be Great Britain. I think we got a piece of that. I'm doing this off the top of my head, and we'll try to put a link up for it. But the big money has been making, this has been part of their supply line for years now, or coming up on centuries now.
Yeah, there's a lot of the Opium War kind of continued with the Vietnam era as well. Yeah.
Yep.
Okay, let's proceed to figure out how it is that our guest ended up a guest of the federal law enforcement system. All right. So really jump in there. You find yourself out of the service, disillusioned with the whole world, with the government, with the military. Your whole world's upside down. Where are we at then?
Well, then I'm going back to college. I tried to make use of that money. I got a bachelor's degree in data processing and started doing computer consulting, writing software. I was a systems analyst. And I traveled around the country some, did work for various groups. Some of them were government contractors. Some of them was directly working for government. I did that for a number of years, and I got married, and I had a nice place out in Arizona for a while. And ultimately, I ended up coming back to Michigan, settling down up in the upper portion of Michigan, and running into a neighbor who was affiliated with the Michigan militia. And that's where things kind of started to fray a little bit. I decided I was going to try to open a store here in Michigan, a military surplus store, actually, with my cousin, who is a big fanatic of that kind of thing. And we were going to try to open that around Brighton. It's a town kind of downstate. But they wanted a lot of rent. There's a really expensive district down there that we're going to open up, and they wanted just huge rent for a storefront. So I had a whole lot of inventory for this store, and I couldn't really afford all the other upfront expense. I mean, the startup cost was getting big. So I decided to hold the inventory and maybe open in a smaller place like upstate around a place like Kalkaska or Mansalona, which you'd have to look on the map with a magnifying glass to find it. And, some low rent place just out of the way and just kind of, live a relatively quiet, obscure life. Anyways, the militia guys, kind of tapped me, and then 9/11 happened, and that was, kind of all happened all together. And with 9/11 happening, I recognized in those buildings falling down that wasn't, the result of a fire and a steel structure, and the whole structure just failed and collapsed. That's just not a story anybody sensible would believe. Again, I was in the military. We did demolition there. And so, I know what it takes to cut steel and, bring down bridges and things. So I know we're not, we weren't looking at a building that just failed because I threw some gasoline and some steel girders on a bridge, because that doesn't work. Okay, that's just simply a lie. And so I'm not going to buy that story. And so being a thinking, intelligent person and realizing that's not how the world works, and not being willing to eat the lies, because I was part of the branch of the service that would generate, create, and disperse those lies to what was supposedly the enemy. But again, the enemy has turned into the American people. And so now, I see that, now that I'm in the civilian world, that I am now the enemy of those people who I used to work with on the inside. And recognizing all this, I realize the government's declaring war on the people with those murders that they committed in New York. And particularly when you look at Building 7 that fell down, they announced it fell before it even fell, and then it fell the same way as the other buildings, and it didn't even hit by anything. These kind of things are signs that we're in a terrible, terrible way. And so I didn't have a whole lot of compunction about being co-opted by the militia at that point in time, because I felt like we were in a pretty desperate situation. Unfortunately, that some of the people from the militia who came to work with me are probably not genuine and sincere in their beliefs, might well even been informant types infiltrated right off the get-go. But, well, that's how life happens. And so that's where I ended up involved in the Michigan militia. And, of course, I had the big surplus, the military surplus inventory, and that was very attractive to the militia people. And so so they set up a camp at my farm up in the upstate in Michigan. And from there, it went to building guns, building machine guns, and, you know, some various training type of things there. Not a whole lot, but some. A lot of people came there and stayed in camp there. Met a lot of people in the militia. And ultimately, there was a situation with someone named Scott Woodring, another militia person up there in Newaygo County, which happened in July of 2003, which was not very far from me at all. And that led to Scott Woodring's death. And, of course, there's, you know, the government story on that, and then the truth that all the people who live there know, which is that when the police came to serve some bogus warrant on Scott Woodring, they, you know, came in with their SWAT team to get a militia guy, and they ended up shooting two of their own people in the back. Sad but true. It, you know, it's their own screw up. It's their own, you know, bloodthirsty, trigger happy kind of approach to things. And they just, you know, shot their own people. You know, hey, it breaks my heart, but it happened. But they did not have the, you know, the integrity to stand up and say this is what happened. Instead, they wanted to blame it on the militia guy because, you know, the state police cannot possibly look like the retards and morons and, you know, bloodthirsty killers that they really are. That they have as a reputation here in Michigan. And so as a result, they had to, I guess you'd say, hunt down Scott Woodring and murder him because he was the only real, you know, firsthand witness to what really happened. And so they shot him in the back about 20 times when he surrendered some days later. And then they made a big charade of blowing up his house. There's a video of that on the internet where they, you know, just burnt his house down. There was video even of them flying attack helicopters, like Cobra-type attack helicopters, and machine gunning his house from the air. I mean, it was just unbelievable. I went to his house after it was just butchered and slaughtered by the government to cover up the evidence, you know, to get rid of all the forensics, you know, to get rid of the evidence that the police shot their own people in the back. You know, that's the only reason crime scenes ever disappear is when it's a government crime. That's when the crime scenes get destroyed. Otherwise, you would think they'd be there to preserve the crime scene and want to go in with all their forensics and prove this bullet and that bullet actually shot somebody. Nope, and they don't want to see any of that. And it's all going to be destroyed, and it'll just be our story versus yours, and you're the dead guy, so you aren't going to answer back. And that's what they did to Scott Woodring. So there was some story that was perpetrated out there that machine guns that were that the militia had created it there on my farm were somehow going to be used for revenge on the police, which was just crap. It was just a wild story, but that got floated in the media. It was some wild story that that there was going to be some ambush of the police on some highways or something, and that's a wild story, just garbage. I think at one point there was a discussion as regards how do the people deal with government, a bloodthirsty government attack like we witnessed, you know, on the TV news, which I don't think really circulated too widely beyond the local area there, where you saw the government, you know, machine gunning this person's house from the air. where you saw them, you know, with APCs around that, you know, and then just surrounded by people and just, you know, shooting this house up like crazy. You know, you wonder, what do you do when the police are engaging in a, you know, what appears to be just a straight out massacre of somebody and their family, you know, in their home? What do you do to stop that? And so, you know, in a rather short discussion, I said, well, you know, as a matter of military tactics, you know, and myself having been in the military and, you know, tactics discussions were up, you know, you create a distraction, you create a diversion, you know, you try to get these people drawn away from there. You get, you know, you make trouble for them elsewhere. If you can't deal with them straight at that point where they are, you know, concentrated, then you do other things. And so that led to some wild story that there was some plot to, you know, to kill police or something. And then there was some other stories floated about, you know, that somebody was just going to go aimlessly attack the police or something. And I think that all this stuff was informant garbage that I think ultimately the government realized that was lies and they knew it. I think they knew it right from the get-go, but it was a great story to feed to the media and helps vilify people who are, as they say, anti-government. And it gives them, you know, what looks like some righteous cause to come and attack somebody and grab them. And, you know, that's what they did at my farm. Basically, they wanted to come and attack me and grab me and seize, you know, whatever they could seize then. And so they told a lot of wild stories, like, you know, there was anti-aircraft guns and there was, you know, God knows, I don't know what, there are 50,000 rounds of anti-aircraft ammunition there, and unbelievable landmines and unbelievable stuff. I mean, the list of stuff that they alleged was there, I mean, it was stuff that any rational thinking person would know. This is such a fantastic story. Nobody's going to believe it. Yet the ATF guys were just eating this up because they don't care what tales an informant will tell. They love it when an informant will show up and tell any lie that they know was a lie. And the ATF, I think, later admitted they pretty much knew this was just a fantastic lie. But it was great for feeding to the media. And ultimately, after they abducted me and grabbed my stuff, what they ultimately ended up with was possession of machine guns without their federal permits. And, you know, again, they want to float, you know, the most salacious tales, but ultimately when you get, you know, settled through all the BS, as time went on, you know, they weren't quite so brave to say any of that other stuff anymore. All that stuff sort of disappeared. The whole thing kind of just settled into the dust. And, it was, you know, possession of machine guns. And like Rachel Madcow says there on TV, I think she was out screaming about me, as other liberal leftist commentators have done in the media. They will scream, "Oh, you know, he was in possession of machine guns." Okay, and?
Right. Terry, why don't you jump in here? I'm sure you've got a lot to say on what our guest has said so far.
Yeah, I just wanted to kind of, from a historic point of view, George Washington was head of the Virginia militia. Thomas Jefferson, when he was governor of Virginia, second governor of Virginia, was head of their militia. I would assume he was their chief executive officer. Abraham Lincoln, militia. Daniel Boone, colonel, the first Kentucky colonel, militia. And that list goes on and on and on and on. So did you ever pick up any indication of how they've managed to come up with the demonization of something that, as I recall, the Second Amendment of the Constitution says, and I hope I don't mess this up, but a well-ordered militia being a desirable part of society, it is the right of the government to keep, it is the right of the people to keep and bear arms. Did any of the guys that you were working with, aside from the ones that were dropping a dime on you for the court proceedings, did any of them have any kind of a feeling about just how this demonization, what were your feelings about that in real time?
Well, in real time, I did what I could to try to defend against this, but they pretty much hold you hostage and incommunicado to some degree. I mean, they controlled my communications in large part to going through one of their, you know, top informants. So pretty much anything I was seeking in terms of help went through their informants, so they knew exactly what I was trying to deal with. So that was always a, you know, the informant was always the obstruction. And then, of course, they gave me a you know, one of these phony government-appointed attorneys as well. And so, I, you know, not really being versed in the law at that point, I did later, while I was abducted, take a paralegal course, and now I have a paralegal's diploma. So I did a lot of litigating against them after I figured out what was up and how to deal with them. But initially, they pretty much did everything they could to shut me down. And so a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed, was something I may well have brought up in court, but the judge was unwilling to hear that. The judge pretty much just, you know, blew all that off. And I even had some documentation that I was lucky enough to get from my sister-in-law. I think she actually mailed it directly to the judge on my behalf, which talked about this collective rights theory stuff that they put out, which came out in just post Miller, the 1939 Supreme Court Miller case, which actually wasn't a regular case. It was just kind of an opinion. And at that time, Miller said that military arms were what was protected by the Second Amendment, and that a sawed-off shotgun was not standard military armament, and so thus it was not protected by the Second Amendment. And so when you have you know, a BATF regulation or a congressional, you know, edict, dictate, statute, they call it, I think, that says that sawed-off shotguns need to be registered under their Firearms Act, under the NFA. I think that was 1938 they enacted that. They said, well, the Supreme Court said, well, that's okay. They can do that because a sawed-off shotgun is not, as far as they know, part of the standard military arms. Of course, if you carry that forward to today, I think even Ron Paul has put out some material, and I was looking around for that article. I was hoping to scan it and send it, but I think he wrote that in one of his articles as a congressman here, and he still is in Congress, that M16s would be the standard military arm of today, which, of course, is a machine gun, and that would be a standard arm. And so that would certainly show that the prohibitions against machine guns, 18 U.S.C. 922-0 sub 1, are really violations of the Second Amendment. So the, you know, this whole issue about, you know, the machine guns and the law, you know, basically we're looking at the Second Amendment just being thrown in the garbage. And they created this fraud that they called collective rights theory back in about 1941. And I did actually document all this, the progression of this, in a book I called Unmistakable Tyranny, which I should probably find a link for. And I really need to update it for the DC v. Heller case. It's been on my list of things to do. But it basically it shows the progression of all the court cases that twisted the Second Amendment into something that was not an individual right. And so when I came into my case and I brought this up, well, the court's not willing to hear that because they've already decided for some 70 years that you don't even have any rights as an individual to even bring up the Second Amendment, that the Second Amendment is not a right of the people. It's not an individual right. They don't even have to listen to your Second Amendment argument. And of course, my court-appointed attorney already knew this, and he wasn't even going to bring it up. Joseph Dooley was his name. And Joe Dooley wasn't even about to even discuss this. We aren't going to have this discussion, you know, and I can understand his perspective on that, to just, you know, play devil's advocate. I can understand, because as attorneys, they're supposed to know how the game is played in court. And if you bring up anything that makes a court look bad, they're going to be on his butt. And so they aren't going to, you know, he's not willing to do that and go out, you know, on a limb for me. But I did present papers through my sister-in-law that you know, documented that collective rights theory, which says that only this, that somehow the Second Amendment has been twisted into only a right of the state to keep and bear arms, is just a complete fraud. And it took 70 years of this fraud for it finally to be addressed in D.C. v. Heller in 2008 in the Supreme Court. And when the Supreme Court did finally admit that all this is a lie and a fraud, they did nothing, nothing to undo all the wrongs and damages that have been done to everyone in the meantime. They just turned their back entirely on that.
Not even, oops, we're sorry.
No, not even. No, what they did, I think it's in footnote 23 on there that says, well, you know, yeah, we may have made a few mistakes, but those judges, you know, who did all that, well, you know, they're good old boys and we love them still. And so I throw this up to the judge in my case, Gordon J. Quist, here in the Western District of Michigan, and he refuses to address the matter. Matter of fact, he even denied my appeals on this, even though the Supreme Court basically says in case law that he cited that he really does have to give me an appeal to address this. He refuses to do so. He doesn't want to be the guy that ends up bringing up, you know, springing the can of worms here. He doesn't want to be, you know, a non-team player for the commies who are trying to who are destroying the Bill of Rights. Okay, he wants to be seen as one of those good old boys, you know, who deserves his pension and or whatever they get from the Supreme Court. I guess they get, you know, until they die, until they're too senile to walk or whatever, until the hookers don't find them attractive anymore. I'm not sure what it is, how long they keep those Supreme Court, those judges here in the federal courts, but I guess they keep them until they finally have to preserve them in formaldehyde or something. So they, huh?
Dude, we just got a question from the chat room.
Yeah.
Can I take my question?
Sure.
All right. The question is, what about personal sovereignty? What would you reply to that?
What about your own personal sovereignty?
Yeah, I guess it's in reference to your case. You know, I'm not sure if that's the question, but go ahead.
Well, I did look into some sovereignty issues as a paralegal while I was abducted. And I had a really, really hard time finding places where they were getting much ground. And not that I don't feel that they have good standing and good arguments, but just like the Second Amendment issue, it's hard to find a place where you can, you know, get legal traction, I guess you would say, and move forward. I mean, even though those people won D.C. v. Heller, nobody got anything as far as Second Amendment rights restored. I mean, none of the laws were overturned. And just as you look at sovereignty issues and you want to, and I can't say I'm the expert on that by far, but even if you wanted to say that you have superior rights, the state's just not going to honor that. You know, they have a monopoly on power. And power comes from the muzzle of a gun. They're willing to kill and you're not. And so who really has the power? And, you know, even though you may have good law behind you and you may have, you know, historical precedent, you know, in ACES, it doesn't seem to matter. The courts are tyrannical and they have, you know, legions of officers willing to eat out our substance. And we have legions of idiots out here who are willing to pay them that tribute so they can be agents to eat out our substance and kill us. And that's where we're at. I mean, I think they have some good arguments, but I wish I could say I knew more, maybe something more specific.
Hey, Mark,
can you touch? Oh, sorry about
that.
Harry. Go ahead. I just wanted to touch based on jury nullification here. Is that something that you've also found some familiarity with? There's a book called We the Jury that addresses jury nullification. Could you kind of give some background on that?
Well, I can't say I'm familiar with that particular thing, but I'm familiar with FEJA, the Fully Informed Jury Association. I love FEJA, the whole idea behind that. And you know, I totally support that, and I do believe there's a lot to be said for that. But unfortunately, I think all the folks they brought in the grand jury in my case were henpecked retards and idiots. And same thing for what would have been picked for, you know, my jury in the trial. They would have done the same thing. It would, you know, the public at large is brainwashed by the media, and they do not know they are entitled to judge the law. And they are basically just spoon-fed what to believe, and then they just nod their heads like lemmings all in a row, and they just, you know, they do what they're told. The judge says you have to find them guilty if such and such is the facts, and then the judge says the facts are this, and so what's the jury going to do? Nod their heads, yes, they must be guilty. And they don't even think that the Second Amendment says something, and you're not allowed to bring up the Second Amendment, you're not allowed to, you know, bring up anything about the history, you know, or what the original intent is. You know, you're not, I mean, so much of your defense when you're bringing up a constitutional issue, which I did, and I preserved that, you know, from my own court proceedings, I preserved a Second Amendment argument, which I'll tell you is very, very rare. I had to actually bring it up myself. By the time we actually got moved forward, I'd complained enough about my attorneys that the judge actually let me personally bring up an issue that my attorneys would not bring, and I preserved a Second Amendment argument, but for my appeals, but not that they would listen to it, because at that time, collective rights theory was still the law of the land while my appeals were going on, and by the time it came along, again, once the judge got his nose bloodied by Heller, he wasn't going to deal with it. He was going to simply deny, and he didn't care how tyrannical he had to be. He was not going to be the next guy on the list to bring up a Second Amendment case and deal with anything. He was not going to do that. He was not going to stand up for the Bill of Rights or the rights of the people at all. He was going to do everything he could, lie, duck, steal, whatever he had to do to avoid doing the right thing for the people. He's just a tyrannical piece of, you know, doo-doo. So I'm not sure how I answered your question there.
I think you touched on it real well, and we'll try and get a link up for that book, We the Jury. Jury nullification is probably one of the most important things about trying to get the justice system back on its feet. And the Supreme Court, as I understand it, and I'm not a lawyer, I'm just a historian, the Supreme Court did admit, at least at some point, that jury nullification is the law of the land.
Mm-hmm.
James was mentioning that there's a newspaper article, one of our most popular articles, was talking about a guy. Can you go into that, James? Are you there, James?
Yeah, I'm here. There's a blog somewhere out there, and it was posted by Marklar, our co-host out there. In fact, Marklar, you're next with a question if you're ready. Talking about a disabled veteran who got caught with some pot, and he won the case with jury nullification. And, you know, it's huge, and it's one of the most popular blogs on the site. All right, Marklar, why don't you jump in there on that one?
Oh, well, I really don't know what I can say there, except that I would go ahead and agree with Terry on the fact that jury nullification is an extremely important issue, probably one of the most underserved issues of our times, with all the things that we talk about when it comes to Wall Street and other legal theories and this and that. You know, and really, jury nullification has a very noble history in that, for instance, a lot of the Jim Crow laws were originally overturned. Are not really overturned, but they stopped getting prosecuted. The prosecutors were no longer so much willing to prosecute under some of these Jim Crow laws of the South, simply because juries would nullify and refuse to convict under those laws.
You know, we were going to talk about the MIAC document, too. You know, you got to wonder, David, do you think that you were a target being because you were a veteran? Does that give an extra priority, do you think, to these spooks out there hunting down all these American terrorists?
Absolutely. It hypes that. in the BATF agent. His name was Mark Semear, S-E-M-E-A-R. And Mark Semear...
Oh, I love it that you're naming names. Keep it up, buddy.
Yeah, I love to do that, too, because people need to know who the enemy is. Mark Semear documented in an affidavit to the magistrate judge when he was looking for an arrest warrant for me. He documented that he was one of the investigators at the Pentagon. And so you know what happened at the Pentagon, right, on 9/11, right? No airplane hit the Pentagon, okay? So he's basically documenting as part of his credentials that, you know, he was an investigator at the Pentagon, so you know the people they brought to bear against me, okay? They brought all their best liars, their best fraudsters, and, you know, their best good old boy team players who would tell whatever tale they wanted to tell. Of course, that's why he was more than happy to take whatever lies he could get from informants and not care that they were lies that any rational person would just say, what, are you kidding me? You know, he would write that garbage up and then take it to the judge. And along with that, of course, you know, he's playing that current, you know, that mentality of just like what's in the MIAC report, that veterans are a threat. And so he investigated me and documents in his affidavit that I'm a military veteran, special forces, and that this is something they, you know, really need to be concerned about. That makes me, you know, all the more, you know, problematic that they have to go after me. So that's also in the in their documents. That you know, they consider military people to be a threat, and I find that really repugnant to everything that America stands for. I mean, people who are willing to stand up and defend this country, you know, volunteer. I mean, I was a volunteer, you know, at a very unpopular time. You know, post Vietnam, you know, there was so much hatred of the military and the government from Vietnam that for me to volunteer then, I took a lot of crap for that. And I lost my girlfriend over it. You know, I went through a lot of grief over, you know, taking that path. And, you know, for them to come back then and then repudiate me because I'm a military veteran, as if I'm somehow somebody extra threatening now to the integrity of America. You know, that somehow my judgment is now questionable because I was a military veteran, that somehow I am no longer trustworthy because I'm a veteran, is really repugnant to any common sense. I mean, other people, I mean, take that to the Veterans of Foreign Wars Hall and tell that to them, that all of you are now considered suspect because you served honorably, that you got an honorable discharge, that you served the country, and now we hold you in contempt for that. Because that's exactly what Mark Semear did to me in those court documents. Instead of saying, well, you know, maybe we should question this, is really Somerville really, you know, a bad guy? Because look, he has all this good history. You know, he's got his bachelor's degree. You know, he's regrettably paid his taxes. You know, he's been a good citizen all this time. He served his country honorably, but now we're going to hold that stuff against him. Now he's a bad guy because he served his country honorably. How does that work?
You know what, David? It really is just the lowest point in American history when a veteran is put on a target list before being a veteran. But, you know, it doesn't get any more. I mean, but the ridiculousness does not stop there. If you have a map in your car, if you take pictures of scenic places in the United States, you're a terrorist, not potential terrorist. I mean, if you're just doing what Americans do, you're now on the government's list for whatever reasons. It doesn't stop. Hey, would you give us a quick fill-in about the MIAC document for many people out there that haven't heard about it? This is about a year-old story out of Missouri.
Do you want me to tell you about the MIAC document?
Yeah, would you like to tell our listeners? what you recall about it?
Well, what I recall about it is this was the their fusion center. They're telling us about all the people who are considered to be threats to the security of America, people that should be considered suspect. I think they had a whole bunch of different kind of people on that list. People who carry the Constitution, people who are, you know, who bring up the Constitution, people who, you know, question any government authority, people who, you know, who are standing up for their rights, you know, and anybody who's considered, you know, to be questioning authority in any way, basically ended up on in that report as being basically suspected terrorists. Is what they, I think they ultimately came up with in that document. So they really went across the board and attacked a lot of people in that document. I think I have it on my computer desktop here. I should probably reread that again.
Yeah, isn't it? I mean, you know, we can't remind people enough about this. You know, every time I see a support our troops sticker and I have an opportunity to talk to one of our sheeple with their little Chinese support our troops sticker, I tell them about that. I said, you know, because people are coming back from the war that they're an automatic terrorist list now? They go, oh, really? Yeah, that's the truth. All right, Terry Bain, what do you got to jump in there with?
I just really we'll try and hopefully we can get some links up on some of these different topics, the documentation that we were touching base on. I'd just like to say from the Vietnam vets that I knew, the one thing that they really seemed to, more than anything else, somebody needs to tell them welcome home. And I keep thinking back to Scott Olson, who was the Marine veteran shot in the head in Oakland that triggered off the first port shutdown, kind of led the second port shutdown to try to get the violence shut down and the lawlessness shut down. Again, the Veterans for Peace seems to have been targeted during that time. I'd just like to say, personally, to a veteran, welcome home.
I do have a question. I'm wondering, David, in regards to this judge and his essential dismissal of your Second Amendment arguments. What I'm wondering is did you ever look into actually filing some kind of a judicial misconduct complaint, or have you maybe found that it's simply so endemic, this sort of behavior, that that it simply wouldn't be taken seriously, or...
Well, as judicial misconduct complaints goes, I filed a bunch of them. I went after the magistrate judge who fraudulently claims that he issued a valid search warrant. I went after Gordon Quist for having ordered a search warrant, whatever bogus search warrants that were that supposedly existed to be produced. And then subsequently he allowed these other court officers and other court staff to not produce it for like 10 months. They just ignored his court order. So basically they were all in contempt of his order. And then the day after my opportunity to file an appeal, they found this document supposedly. They doctored one up. So, of course, they, you know, went to the day after I had any opportunity to actually use it in my appeals and show the fraud. I filed misconduct charges against, of course, extensive complaints against that magistrate judge, and documented, I mean, in detail. I went after documents and documents and documents. I got, you know, documents with signatures, original documents. I mean, I know there's multiple original fraudulent documents issued. I nailed them hard. And I documented a bunch of it. I sent complaints to D.C. I sent complaints to judges in the Sixth Circuit, to individual circuit court judges. I documented attacks on me and misconduct at various points in time all through my proceedings with these people. My court dockets are loaded with my complaints against the judges. And I'll tell you, at times I think it injured their ego because they were just busted and they couldn't do anything about it. And there was one point in time when I got thrown in the hole in prison for doing that, for going after one of the judges. You know, too bad. You're busted. What a shame. You know, and so their retaliation was, just teach this guy a lesson. So they did what they could there, to torture me for a while. Basically, I did not leave the, judicial misconduct complaints out of the loop at all. But again, the people you're appealing to are other judges, and it's all one good old boys club. And when you are considered to be a militia person, that's instant death. You're not going to get anywhere.
So what's the modus operandi there? Do they simply disappear that stuff down a black hole of nothingness, or do they at least send you some letter with some spurious legal justification as to why they're not going to pursue anything in regards to that? Or
right, you're right. They almost to a fault. Almost 99% of the time, absolutely denied, ignored even having this stuff filed. They did everything. I mean, I really had to track down and pursue the Sixth Circuit in some complaints, thinking, well, maybe the Court of Appeals will be some decent folks. Maybe they're not as dishonest and corrupt as the Western District of Michigan is here in this federal building. They're a bunch of corrupt scum. These people are just viciously corrupt. So I thought, well, okay, maybe they're not all that way in the Sixth Circuit. I found it otherwise, that they pretty much are. I got very little in the way of even acknowledgement that complaints were filed. And ultimately what they do is say, well, your complaints get forwarded to another commission. And ultimately this commission decides what they're going to do, and you will never know what they decide. That whatever they come up with for discipline or resolution of the matter, you're never going to know. It's not going to be something that you're going to be a party to, whatever they come up with. So I can file this stuff and put it on the record that there is judicial misconduct, and I can document it at length. And boy, I did. I mean, I documented stuff, tooth and nail.
Wow, that's just amazing that the official thing would be that you can complain, but you'll never know what we decide.
Right, and that it goes to other people that you don't even have, you don't get to know. It's what do they call that? It's another group of people. Well, it's some administrative body. It's if you look in the court rules, you'll see it in there. They talk about them. And I can't say it's right on the tip of my tongue right now, but basically there's a different group of administrators in each court of appeals that deals with that, and they handle that. And like I say, you will never know if or what they ever do about your complaints. So, yeah, but I did that. And I think it did. I think it did have some impact a couple of times. I do. Because some of the stuff I put out was just so damning that I can't imagine that, anybody with any conscience, anybody with any kind of concern about what's on the public record would probably just be appalled at what's going on the record. And, the only thing that judges really lay claim to is this famous, one-liner they have that's public confidence in judicial proceedings. And when you can just utterly eviscerate, documentedly, public confidence in anything that they are doing up there, when you can document that these people have subverted the Bill of Rights for 70 years, when you can document that they are willfully subverting your rights and committing fraud as regards the facts, as regards, compliance with Supreme Court rulings as regards, you know, court orders, when you can document that court staff are corrupt, when you can document that the judges are corrupt, you know, at some point, you know, it hits home. At some point, they've got to feel really embarrassed that this stuff is out there. I mean, I know that there's like next to nobody out there in the world who gives a rat's ripe rump about my case. Okay. But the stuff is out there and it's
not. We do. That's why we're asking, David. There are people out there, man.
But you know, I mean, ultimately, you know, it's only there for the very, very, very few people. And it's just like, it's like a mouse squeak, you know, in the roar of the crowd. It's next to nothing that's ever going to be heard, but boy, is it sure damning. And I've had so many people tell me, you know, write a book about this. I get one woman who's very well connected to a lot of people who's trying to write the book for me right now, really wants me to do this, and probably very shortly I will. I've got about 30 cartons of legal material from litigation with these guys, and this is a lot of documents, many, many thousands of pages.
Who will play you in the movie, David?
Who's going to play me in the movie?
Well, I got to add, Don in the chat room said you were a ninja. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, Donna's been a big fan of mine. Donna gets a nice pat on the back for that. I really appreciate rocks. That. Thanks.
She is number one out there fighting this. Her site's defined for you. Hey, do you guys, you know, speaking of political prisoners, what is going on with this July 4th Patriot, Charles Dreyer? Now, we have some people that have joined up around these social networks that are putting out both sides of points of view on this guy, that he was a Fed informant from the beginning, and then he got himself stuck, and they, you know, they sacrificed him to the whole cause. And other people are saying he was entrapped from the beginning. Do you know anything about this case and about this guy?
I have never heard anything about it, but I know from being close, you know, in my own case and, you know, being up close and personal with many of the informant things and how the feds do deals, the feds hold informants in ultimate contempt. The feds dislike informants as much as you like squashing
them. That's why I'm really torn about this because, you know, basically people are saying you got to pick one side on this case. And I'm saying I don't think I'm ever going to know the truth about it. You know, these feds, they can really put together a tale. You know, you can't figure out what's up and what's down anymore. This guy, with his handle on YouTube was called July 4th Patriot. And he used to come on at first with his face covered, and it kind of looked, you know, intimidating militia type, you know, the fake media militia type you would see on TV, you know. And a lot of people said, well, there's your evidence right there, you know. In fact, Mike Rivero said that's enough reason to say that he's a Fed. He's trying to be intimidating and blah, 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 incite violence. But the more and more I look at it, I think this guy got railroaded every which way but loose because, you know, it started off that they're investigating him over YouTube about making, you know, threats in the government. And the next thing you know, all of a sudden a family member shows up and says that they raped his little child. And now that's what he's in prison for, you know. If you haven't looked into it, look into it. You know, everybody out there should look at this case because it is just the most bizarre thing ever. You know, it just starts on YouTube, and there's a lot of crazies on YouTube, and there's a lot of feds on YouTube. I mean, I think they have you spinning your wheels all day arguing back and forth about things that really don't matter, like this case, you know. Because, I mean, in the real grand scheme of things, this poor guy got screwed, but people are getting screwed every hour. You know, it doesn't just stop right after his story.
Yep.
Terry or Mark, do you guys know anything about the July 4th Patriot?
No, I've heard some mention of the name. I think I know who you're talking about now that you described the his YouTube stuff. I think I know exactly who you're talking about, but I can't be sure about that. And yeah, I can't say I really read into it.
Yeah, you know, he decided to unmask himself at one point, and I'm not sure why. I think it's because people already identified him, you know, tracking his IP or whatever, you know. And he was even on the Alex Jones show for a while, a couple spots, and they're talking about infiltration in the militia and what was going on and you know, and being railroaded by the FBI, you know, having them come over. And, you know, he even said people came up to him and said, you know, like, hey, I'm with you, man. Let's go get some grenades, you know, just so really obvious provocateurs, man.
Well, was he kind of like bald with a shaved head with
You'd wear
the black kind of modern combat jacket kind of thing.
Yes, he was the evil Mark Bartle.
Yeah.
All right, back to you, Terry. I think we're running out of time here. We'll round it up.
Looks like we've got about 3 minutes to the hour. I just wanted to thank you for being with us, David. And hopefully we can get some of the links to the things you were talking about that's been documented so we get a chance to get this stuff out where people can see it. It's one thing to hear it. It's another thing to see it in a legal document. So we'd really like to work with you to see if we can get some of those links up here in the next couple of days. I'm really looking forward to it. Thanks for standing, David. And hopefully you'll stay with the Occupy moment. We're nonviolent. Hopefully we can stop ever needing any kind of violence. So far, the violence seems to be directed more at us than, and that's regrettable, but probably historically expected. Anything else from you guys?
I just wanted to add a couple plugs out there. Be looking soon on Amazon.com for David Somerville's book. Mm-hmm. We will Occupy America Social Network. We're involved with 12160 is our pals over there. I mentioned Donna's site, Defiant for You. It's a good site to learn more about political prisoners. And honestly, we really didn't get enough on the political prisoners. I mean, there's so many of them out there, and now the newest version of political prisoners is the whistleblower. The Obama administration is just destroying everybody that's trying to come forward and do the right thing for America.
He did promise transparent government, so.
In doublespeak is exactly what it is.
Yeah.
All right. I want to thank Bradley Menford, Sweet D down in the chat, everybody else that turned out for our show. Troy, he's got a group on 12160 called the No Confidence Party. Check that out. We'll be back next week. We're hopefully going to be having some guests to talk about the fake black bloc up in Canada and various other protest locations. I think, Bradley, you can wrap it up. Thank you, everybody. Thank you, David.
Thank you.